Your Honors, this is the dissolution of marriage case that was heard in Denver District Court in 2012 in front of Judge Eliff. He issued written orders in April, a month later. The final orders were for allocation of parental responsibility or child custody, for division of marital property, for an award of maintenance, and award of child support. Wife had requested attorney's fees under 1410-119 for insufficient time at the hearing to conduct the attorney's fees, so that matter was set for later hearing. Subsequent to that, in July of 2012, several months after divorce, wife filed a written discovery asking for production of documents, including husband's personal and business financial records for the period of time after the decree was entered. Husband filed a motion for protective order, and the court granted the motion, stating that the court was required as a matter of law to consider the parties' financial positions at the date of final orders, not as the date of the later attorney's fees hearing, because the underlying law is that attorney's fees are inextricably linked to the award of support and division of property. The attorney's fees hearing was held in late September of 2012, approximately 6 months after the final orders were entered. The court only committed evidence and testimony as to the parties' financial positions as of the day of the final orders hearing. That was based on its earlier ruling granting protective order. The court found that the party's fees were very high in the case, almost 40% of the marital estate. Wife's fees are over $90,000. Husband's fees were $76,000. After hearing testimony from the parties, the court denied attorney's fees award from husband to wife, holding that each party was in an equivalent, more or less equivalent financial position as a result of final orders, but that husband was significantly less financially liquid than wife, and husband had already paid $20,000 of her fees as part of temporary orders. The wife filed an appeal to the Court of Appeals, claiming that the trial court erred in not allowing her to put on evidence of the party's financial positions at the later attorney's fees hearing, as opposed to the date of the final orders hearing. And also that therefore the court used its discretion in granting a protective order, keeping her from inquiring as to husband's post-decree finances. Court of Appeals reversed the trial court, holding that as a matter of equity, the trial court must look at the party's financial circumstances at the date of the later attorney's fees hearing, not the date of the final orders hearing, and also vacated or reversed the court's ruling granting a protective order. The Supreme Court granted cert on this issue. What's the proper time for looking at the party's financial circumstances in the later fees hearing under 1410-119? The date of the final orders hearing or the date of the later attorney's fees hearing?
Good morning, Mr. Lamb. Can I ask you a question? How often is there a delay of this length in permanent orders hearings? Is this an outlier or is this common practice?
Being as attorney's fees are the last thing heard in a contested divorce, if anything gets continued, it tends to be the attorney's fees.
Sure, but I'm talking about the length of it.
Oh, you're talking about court docket and setting.
This was 6 months out, right?
6 months is pretty long. 3 months is more typical, I would say.
Okay, so there's typically a delay in those.
Oh, yeah. If you're asked, we had a half-day hearing on attorney's fees. That goes on the court's regular docket. You're set back with everybody else months later.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
May I just follow up on that point? Would you say it's more typical to try and resolve all of those issues at the same time? In other words, all the money issues, including fees.
You mean in a contested final orders hearing?
Yes.
We certainly try to do that. And
because they are inextricably intertwined.
Right. We certainly try to do that, but cases run over and fees are heard after everything else. So if anything gets continued, it's typically fees. I get continued on fees more than not.
In Denver?
I practice primarily in Boulder, but I practice all over Colorado for 20 years, and that's been my experience.
All right.
As a result, many times we just forget about it. I think that's all the court's hope is counsel just forget about the fees issue and that's the end of it. But when they're big, it's not necessarily the case.
So let me just follow up with one other question, as long as we're interrupting right now, I apologize. Why should the issuance of the decree determine when the permanent orders hearing, in a sense, is finished, or should it?
The issuance of the decree really doesn't determine the finality of final orders. In terms of appealability, for example, it's not final under the Wells case, I believe, until there's been orders for property division support and attorney's fees. Typically, the decree is entered at that same time, so we use that as a benchmark for stopping the clock. But in the attorney's fees context, there's got to be prior orders for property and support before the court can enter the order on attorney's fees. So we've got 40 years clear and consistent case law on this issue up until the time the Court of Appeals entered its opinion in this case. And they're all based on the concept is inextricably intertwined. That I don't, a lot of you probably realize where the phrase came from. It goes back to the prior case law. Or basically, the phrase came from arbitration, litigation, mixed cases, and the rule at that time from this court was you can't force arbitration if there's mixed litigation arbitration clause. That's where the phrase inextricably intertwined came from. This court rejected that in 2007, I believe. But Court of Appeals picked up the phrase and uses it all the time in this exact instance when there's fees tied to property and support. So tearing apart the inextricably intertwined doctrine, you'll probably all be sick of hearing about it by the time I'm done with it. In a divorce case, the final orders, the court first has to consider the division of marital property under 14.10.113. In doing so, it's to look at other things, the economic circumstances of the spouse. After it made findings and orders on property division under 14.10.114, it considers a request for maintenance or alimony or support, all the same thing. And making findings and orders to support, the court has to look at the gross incomes of the parties and the marital property awarded to each party, and then a bunch of smaller factors. But those are the two big ones, income and property was just awarded under 113. And under the Jones, this court's 1981 case, Mary Jo Jones, the property award must follow, or the maintenance award must follow the property award. You can't do it in reverse order. And then the third thing that the trial court does is award attorney's fees if there's a request under 14.10.119. The statute says the court's to consider the financial resources of both parties when it makes that award. 119 is very brief, it's just a few sentences. The other statutes go on for pages. So that's where we get back to inextricably intertwined.
Well, where's the final judgment and all that? Just
say again.
Where's the final judgment and all that? The judgment not final until the attorney's fees are entered.
That's correct. Okay. Right. And it can't be appealed until there's been a final
complete disposition goes all the way through the attorneys. It's
yes.
Not some collateral issue or
no, it's really is inextricably intertwined. I think that, yeah, I can't remember which appellate case holds that, but, I think it's Wells. So anyhow, the way I look at inextricably intertwined in the context of the divorce is look at a math equation. It's got three variables, the first one being property division. When that's solved, the court goes on and solves the maintenance variable. And when those two are solved, as a matter of law, based on the findings and orders for property and maintenance, the court then orders attorney's fees. It can't consider attorney's fees out of the context of the property and support orders. And therefore, it's irrelevant when the attorney's fees issue is heard, whether it's 6 hours after the property and support orders, 6 days later, or in the case here, 6 months later. The passage of time between each of those findings is not relevant. Just like solving a math equation, it takes you 3 days to solve it, it's still the same equation. In this case, the trial court applied the strict linear time doctrine and they got it right. So there's, as I said when I opened, there's about 40 years of consistent case law on point here. This court, in the Huff decision, 1992, said an award of attorney's fees must be reviewed in light of the party's financial circumstances after the property division and any maintenance award. Well, there's prior appellate case law, and there's subsequent appellate case law, but this court's never used the phrase any strictly intertwined. That's been solely the Court of Appeals, but this court's decision in Huff and five or six other cases involving attorney's fees and divorce certainly support the inextricably intertwined doctrine.
Mr. Lennon, can I stop you there? How would you respond to the Court of Appeals' opinion on page six? They have a long list of a string cite of cases that talk about the purpose of an award of attorney's fees is to apportion the cost of dissolution equitably based on the current financial resources of the parties. And so I think really, to me, it seems like we have to figure out what that word current means. Current at the time of the hearing or current at the time of the...
Right. And that's what inextricably intertwined means. The passage of time between property award, support award, and attorney's fees award is not relevant. And that's where the Court of Appeals erred.
Why is it not relevant if the court... Because the award of attorney's fees is an equitable... Power,
right.
Correct?
Right.
Why would the passage of time, why wouldn't you want all relevant information before you to make that decision?
You're looking at equity in the context of the divorce, the division of property to each spouse, and award maintenance and the child support to each spouse. That's the equity. What somebody is doing 6 days, 6 months, 6 years post-decree is really nobody's business but theirs. Nobody should be looking at those parties' financial situation that far after final orders to talk about equity. And that's what inextricably intertwined is all about. And that's what the cases I'm going to discuss from prior Court of Appeals opinions make clear. This Court of Appeals opinion relies on two cases, Yates and the Wells case. And I'm going to talk about why neither of them was interpreted correctly by the Court of Appeals here. Call case, 1972, the first Court of Appeals case. Question of attorney's fees is similar time complying with the question of property division. The allowance of attorney's fees cannot be set aside with it by this court without setting aside the entire order. Wormhole, 1985, issues of property division, maintenance and attorney's fees are inextricably intertwined. Since we remanded for property division, we can't comment. Basically said we have to reconsider attorney's fees on remand. Hill, because the issues are inextricably intertwined, must be reconsidered the award of maintenance and the portion of attorney's fees in light of the new property division. Attorney's fees always follows maintenance and property. It's not out there floating on its own months post-decree. Nelson case, same thing, Court of Appeals, 2012. Court must address several intertwined issues, disposition of property, spouse support, attorney's fees. And here's the important thing from Nelson. When the court is considering a post-decree motion to modify parenting time, maintenance, whatever, attorney's fees are no longer inextricably intertwined with property division and support. At that time, in that kind of hearing, and only that kind of hearing, the court can look at the party's post-decree financial situations because there's no longer a link to the property and support division. It's a freestanding litigation post-decree as opposed to most of the Court of Appeals cases, which are remands.
So what is the extent of that post-decree litigation?
Motions to modify, parenting time, child support, maintenance under maintenance.
And that's kind of an ongoing situation?
That can be ongoing as long as both spouses are alive. Yeah, most attorneys are aware a case has been dragging out for 10 years.
So does this equitable attorney's fees award apply to that? Is that clear in the law?
It's clear in the law. in that situation for the post-decree modification hearing, the court has to look at the financial circumstances as they exist at the time of that hearing, not at the time of the divorce hearing, because there's no longer a link between their circumstances at that point in time and what happened in a prior divorce hearing.
Counsel, before you move on, can I just, yeah, this in, hello. Can I get you, well, I guess your point is that we have to have a snapshot for the property, and that's kind of a point in time, and that the attorney's fees have to be determined based on that. Otherwise, I guess later, if we did attorney's fees later, you'd have to reconsider property as well. That's the implication.
Property and support.
And support.
And that's what the Court of Appeals decision says here. If you're gonna look at the economic circumstances at the time they come back in court on attorney's hearing months later, you gotta relook at their financial circumstances. And under all the case law and statute, financial circumstances include what is their property today? Has their business increased in value as alleged in this case? Did a house burn down? Did somebody get a promotion? Somebody get laid off? All that would have to be relooked at one more time when you go back just on attorney's fees. And the only winners, in my opinion, are the attorneys. You're going to have a lot more attorney's fees and a lot more court time getting used up to re-examine financial circumstances under the law. And aside from that, that's not a law. We have 40 years of consistent law saying it's financial circumstances, the date of final orders, the control for attorney's fees, regardless of that hearing is held.
Okay, can I just ask a follow-up? Can you help me? I know you're relying on interpretations of statutes, but I guess I'm wondering, do you have any hook for your argument in the statute itself, or the statutory language itself? Anywhere. I'll take the statute
119?
Anywhere. Yeah. I mean, right, that's, I mean, 119, is there anything in the language that supports your argument, or do you think that the statute's just kind of inapplicable generally, in this case?
Well, I'm not supposed to read extensively from statutes, I know, but it's so brief, it won't be extensive. 119, the court from time to time, after considering the financial resources of both parties, may order paraphrasing award of attorney's fees.
Right, is there anything in that? Right, is there, okay. And I understand that's a short, but I guess I'm wondering if you have any argument that language either, I guess you would argue, supports your position.
The case law interpreting, 40 years of clear and consistent case law always interprets Delta's Court of Appeals decision. That means you look at the financial circumstances that resulted from the property division and the maintenance award. So it's one of those fairly vague statutes that has to be interpreted for case law, and it has been since 1978.
But we have not interpreted it, is that right?
You did in the Huff case.
Okay.
Yeah, it's saying an award of attorney's fees must be reviewed in light of private parties' financial resources after property division's minimum maintenance award. Property maintenance
after, attorney's fees. After is kind of a relative term.
And then the Court of Appeals goes on to clarify using inextricably intertwined in numerous cases, 40 years of cases.
Since we're not bound by the Court of Appeals, does it seem that you should be making an argument to us why we would want to do that?
Well, I think you'd want to keep doing what you did in the Huff case.
Well, it seemed like as Justice Hobbs was just pointing out, at least the language you quoted us only talks about an order, not the timing. It only seems to suggest that we need to know what the property division and maintenance orders were before we look at attorney's fees. But was there anything about that that suggested they'd have to be based on circumstances that were at the same time, that were simultaneous?
Well, the circumstances are the circumstances that the court creates by dividing property and entering maintenance. And the attorney's fees are equitable in that context, as part of the dissolution of marriage action.
I guess, partly, you've said a couple of times in response to questions that the judgment is not final until after the attorney's fees. and therefore the proceedings are still going on. And when, for instance, in Wells, we talk about looking at the circumstances of the proceedings, at the time of the proceedings, why isn't that until the proceedings become final?
Well, the finality really only goes to appealability. You can't appeal until you got a final decision. But the clock still isn't running to look at the equity of the attorney's fees award outside of the property and the support award. The equity is self-contained in that steps. And one of the Court of Appeals' biggest errors here that really is telling is it cites the Wells case, the 1993 Court of Appeals case, for the proposition that Wells says that you have to look at post-decree financial circumstances with an award of attorney's fees. But Wells is an attorney's fees case, and here's what's really critical and important to understand this. Wells is a property valuation, is remanded for valuation of property. And that's this case, by the way, it's a 1993 case. And this court said, well, we've got to look at the financial circumstances of the property values and the property awarded at the time it came back to the trial court. Because 1410.113.1c, which is the controlling statute, says you look at the economic circumstances of each spouse at the time the division of property became effective. So this court said, well, it got remanded back, so we're redividing property. So the statute requires this, even though we don't really like it, and Justice Breyer in his dissent really didn't like it. The statute says, well, we're compelled to look at the economic circumstances in the property division at the time the division of property become effective. We have to follow the statutory language. If the court's changing the division of property later, they have to look at the circumstance of that day. And here's the link to 119 that the Court of Appeals missed. For the Court of Appeals to be correct in applying Wells to this case, 1410.119 would have to say, you look at the financial circumstances at the time the attorney's fees award has become effective. Well, it doesn't say that. It just said you consider the financial resource of the parties. So Wells, if you're going to use it as a principle of statutory interpretation, completely contradicts what the Court of Appeals did here. Because 119 doesn't even give any guidance at all saying you look at the circumstances at the date that the attorney's fee award would become effective. And the property division in Wells was based on the statutory interpretation. So the Court of Appeals doesn't cite any case law in support of its position. The Yates case, it doesn't support the Court of Appeals. It just says, after the conclusion of permanent order hearing, after acquiring marital property and determining maintenance, the court ordered husband to pay 70% of the attorney's fees. Implicit in that's inextricably intertwined. So Yates doesn't help the Court of Appeals, and Wells totally contradicts it.
Counsel, if I may interrupt you for just a moment. It seems that you take issue with the sort of mandatory nature of the Court of Appeals opinion, that the court must look at the financial circumstances at the time of the attorney's fees hearing, that there's no discretion there. And as I understand your argument, it seems to be a two-piece argument. In other words, under 113, that statute does require that the economic circumstances of the parties at the time of property division, that's what sort of ties to the property division, and then you rely on case law to say, and because fees are sort of based on that, it needs to be kind of tied to that same picture. Is there ever in your mind, though, perhaps some discretion that could be exercised? In other words, in light of changed circumstances, should the court under, you know, I don't know, under certain circumstances, perhaps take into account changed circumstances when we're examining attorney's fees. Is there a, you have an always rule from the Court of Appeals, and I'm not sure if your position is never, never, or it depends, somewhere between.
40 years of case law is never. I'm certainly saying that's the rule here. And whether the Court of Appeals, if it had been right, probably should have said may, not must. That's just a small bone I'm picking with them. But
there isn't even a may. It can't look at post-decree economic circumstances in awarding attorney's fees that came out of the final orders hearing. It can only do that if there's an independent later motion to modify something, and then you're not inextricably linked to those original orders. And this, the inextricably linked doctrine in my mind is just so clear and concise and equitable, and it's been the law for 40 years in Colorado, that the Court of Appeals, without really giving any detailed analysis, would just turn all of that on its head. The implication would be protracted litigation, post-decree, ongoing conflict between spouses. Here we are, 3 years, the divorce is final in 2012, we're still in court. It's a one of the underlying public policy issues is to wind up litigation, not subject parties to continued conflict, not keep running up attorney's fees for reconsidering financial circumstances under situations like this. The equity is built into the system. It's the equity at the time the parties divorce, regardless of when the court orders attorney's fees.
Well, one thing that I was curious about, Judge Ellis made this decision, he made his final orders, he entered the decree, is that right?
Yes.
So at that point, the only thing that was held over was the attorney's fees?
Yes.
Did his final orders anticipate that attorney's fees were pending based upon the decisions he made in the final orders?
Yes.
Could you read us that language?
Paragraph, I deferred ruling on attorney's fees because the parties requested the opportunity to present additional evidence on this issue. Basically, we're running out of time, final orders.
Okay. And so the permanent order itself anticipated that that attorney's fees would be paid on this amount based upon these distributions. That's correct. I'm just looking for that language. I'm not sure you would find that in there.
I'm sorry,
didn't see it.
I'm not quite sure what you're asking for.
Well, I guess the point that I'm trying to get at is that the permanent orders would have included the award of attorney's fees, just the number itself would be left blank, so to speak.
No.
No,
not in this instance. We had no testimony as to the reasonableness and necessity of fees, the financial circumstances of each party, or anything that the court would need to go through the multi-step process. It's like a six-step process to order fees under 119, and we didn't do any of those. Those were all put over until later.
Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead. So, Chair, that kind of argues for the one-time shot at doing it at the time of the attorney's fees hearing and the circumstances existing then. You suggested that it can't involve, after the divisions, right? The circumstances are fixed, but that just doesn't track to me. I'm sorry. It seems to me that at the time of the attorney's fees hearing, you take one shot at what the financial circumstances are of the parties.
So reinvent the financial circumstances again, as opposed to what happened 6 months earlier at the final orders?
I don't know how much work that would have involved in addition. I mean, 3 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years. If there's necessity to prolong the litigation of some sort, I don't know how these cases play out. Never sat on the bench figuring them out. I defer to my colleagues who've been in this position.
May I just interject with a question? I think you may have just misspoken, and you said that there was no evidence regarding the financial circumstances at that time. Maybe I misheard them, but there had been a two-day permanent orders hearing, I imagine much of which was devoted to the financial circumstances of the parties at that point in time. Is that
right? But there was no testimony or findings by the court interpreting the financial circumstances resulting from property and support orders and plugging that into 119. That part of the hearing was not held.
Okay.
And that's all that was not held. Everything else was done.
Thank you.
So I'm about out of time, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much. You have 18 seconds remaining. Thank you. Bailey.
May it please the court, my name is James Bailey. I represent Melissa DeConi in this case. A confession, I tweaked my back. So if I grimace in the middle of this argument, it's not because of a question or because of something I'm saying. During the course of this argument, with all due respect, I'm going to attempt to answer some of the questions that you tendered out to Mr. Lannon in this case, so that I can give you at least some guidance that might go on both sides at this point. The first question really relates to the underlying character now, these days, of what a permanent orders hearing looks like. I practice primarily in the Denver metropolitan area. I do most of the counties that are around here. And I will let you know that, one, as a general rule, attorney's fees are heard at the time of the underlying hearing. Now, I confess, there are cases like this one where it's bifurcated out. But that's the general practice, and that flows from the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure. This court is, of course, aware of Rule 121. It's a subsection of that. It's 1-22. 121 and 122 that says that in a domestic case, attorney's fees should be heard at the time of the hearing. Now, that didn't happen in this case, and there are real reasons why that didn't happen. It's because the parties ran out of time. In entering the court's permanent orders on page 17, Chief Justice Rice, that's where the court has a blurb on attorney's fees. And primarily what the court says in that blurb is, we have an attorney's fees issue here, both parties have spent a tremendous amount of money in this case. Everybody kind of ran out of time. I'm going to continue this over to a further hearing. That hearing took place 6 months later. Now, there's really two components to that delay that I want to talk about. One is this. Right now, the critical issue for domestic practitioners is permanent orders now takes place over a series of days. There are jurisdictions where we don't get 2 days in a row, where we get set for 1 day, and now we have to come back in 6 months. That's the timing issue. And what the Court of Appeals correctly decided as it relates to all of these issues is that the circumstances of the parties that exist at the time the parties appear in front of it are the relevant circumstances. Justice Ide, you had asked a question about whether or not there was any statutory authority under 119 that related to timing. Our answer is no, there's really not. The only timing authority that we have in the statutes relates to section 113, which is the property division statute. And that section says that we look at the circumstances of the parties at the time the property division becomes effective. But here is where the real gloss is. All of the cases in this area are uniform, both as it relates to attorney's fees and as it relates to all other domestic issues. We always look at the circumstances of the parties at the time they appear in front of the court. Well,
can I stop you there since you followed up on my question? Then would it have been appropriate in this instance to relook at property division at the time that attorney's fees were being considered? I mean, that, and you're making, yeah, and I understand you're not making that argument, so tell me why you're not, I mean, why that doesn't flow. Because you're kind of taking a snapshot of financial circumstances at point A, and then you're having attorney's fees based on changed circumstances, right, at point B, but you don't want to go back and redo the property. So can you help me with that?
I can. I think that there's two differences between the two of them. One is we're actually not taking a snapshot at time A. We are creating those circumstances at time A. The snapshot really relates to time B, which is we want to know what those circumstances are as we carve up, or we divide, or we consider what the attorney's fees issues are. And so,
why are you distinguishing between snapshot A and snapshot B? I don't understand that.
Let me rephrase.
Yeah, good.
At the time of the hearing on property, on maintenance, on child support, on the allocation of debt, that's when we establish the circumstances. And that's when we get into the inextricably intertwined language, which is a question of order. It's not intertwined, they're actually dependent, meaning that maintenance is dependent on property because property generates income. Income is relevant for maintenance. attorney's fees is dependent on maintenance because maintenance is income, and a primary consideration for attorney's fees is the party's respective earning capacities. So when I say snapshot A, I'm referring to the permanent orders hearing. That's when we establish the property in this case. That's when the property issues were established. There is no request, and there is nothing that can happen that would rechange those determinations at the attorney's fees hearing. The interdependence doesn't work backwards. We don't reset property because we reset the attorney's fees award. We don't reset property because we reset maintenance. The order only works down.
Well, isn't that what, are you defending the Court of Appeals opinion or not? I mean, isn't that sort of what the Court of Appeals suggests, that there's been this massive change, and we're going to look at that. The attorney's fees stage, perhaps we should relook at what was already determined. I mean, you're saying no.
I don't think that the Court of Appeals opinion can be construed that way. I apologize, maybe I'm wrong, okay? I don't want to overstep my boundaries. But as I look at Mr. Lanham's reference to the Wells decision in the Court of Appeals opinion, which is a property decision, the reference to Wells by Court of Appeals is preceded by a CF site. So for an analogous proposition, we take a look at the equitable considerations that are presented in Wells. But Wells still says the same core principle, which is we always look at the circumstances of the parties at the time they appear in front of us, whether that's property, whether it's maintenance, whether it's child support, and in fact, whether or not it's attorney's fees. I know that Mr. Lanham has said that there are 40 years of case law that says we examine attorney's fees only at the time that we resolve property and maintenance. With all due respect, I don't see that authority. I understand that there's 40 years of authority that uses the phrase inextricably intertwined. And when I do my research on it, that seems to me to come from the case of Crawl. Crawl v. Crawl was a pre-Uniform Dissolution of Marriage Act case where the attorney's fees were in fact allocated as debt. And therefore, you can see the interrelationship between attorney's fees and property. The Crawl decision then gets picked up by In Re Marriage of Singwall, which is now a Uniform Dissolution of Marriage Act case. And it just cites back to the Crawl. And so the intertwined language does not come from and does not relate to the real question that's presented here, which we think is supported by the cases that say the financial circumstances that we're going to look at relate to the current financial circumstances of the parties. And that's where the case law is clear and appears to be direct. For example, I would reference the court to the case In Re Marriage of Defoe, which is cited in the briefing here. In the Defoe case, we have an appeal and an affirmance of permanent orders. There's no reversal in Defoe. And yet the Court of Appeals they affirm and remand for an attorney's fees on appeal. Now, I recognize that that's a little bit different, but
the attorney's fees as of what date?
Well,
based upon the remand, I mean, they were silent with respect to that. They didn't say and determine attorney's fees as of the date of the decree or as of the date of the remand.
I would respectfully disagree.
What did they say?
They said that the attorney's fees would be determined as of the date of the hearing on the remand.
Upon remand.
Yeah.
That's not seen and use, therefore, the date of remand. And in other words, I think we're sort of inartful in our language, to tell you the truth, and I can understand why there's some confusion here. You know, upon remand, determine attorney's fees doesn't mean determine fees as of the financial status the parties have on the date that you have the hearing. And that problem with all of this is that when you're entering permanent orders, you're doing your best to equalize things, and then to the extent that you've been able to equalize things, you're able to ascertain attorney's fees. But there simply has to be an endpoint, a snapshot, or else you constantly have a moving target. And we saw that 100% in this case, where 6 months later, theoretically, the husband has a whole lot more money. If he'd had that money 6 months earlier, half of that should have gone to the wife or whatever the judge decided, I don't really know. And that would have changed the attorney's fees calculation. So it all has to work together. And if you're going, sort of like what Justice Ives suggested, if you're going to assume that you're going to have a different year to look at attorney's fees, well, then that might be fair, but you have to look at everything at that later date as well. Why isn't that true?
May I start by saying, one is, it's not true because the court has entered an order or a judgment on the property and on the maintenance issues. And with respect, property and maintenance are not dependent on attorney's fees. And that's because, for example, you can reverse.
No, but attorney's fees are dependent upon property and maintenance.
Absolutely.
So it seems almost a nonsensical argument to me to take any position other than that these things have to be decided together and at a point certain.
Mr. Bailey, can I come at it from a different angle?
Yes.
Doesn't the statute provide that the value of property and income is determined as of the date of the decree?
The statute provides that the property is to be valued as of the date that it's to become effective. Under this court's decision in Wells, that means that the court examines the financial circumstances of the parties at the time that the parties appear in front of it. For example, and to hit on a prior question, the decree itself fixes what is property, marital property, what is separate property. But we can have a hearing on permanent orders at different times than the decree. And that's why we can have circumstances where we look at, under the Wells decision, at the circumstances of the party.
All right, but in this case, for example, if the decree had been entered, and sometimes people want the decree entered early, and I try to avoid that, but if the decree is entered and then someone goes out and their business appreciates after that, is that not then considered separate property? Because the decree sets the date of when something is marital property and separate property, correct?
I would disagree with your analogy. I agree with the specific facts. If, for example, the decree fixes the date for the creation of marital property and separate property. So income, which is earned after the date of the decree, is separate property. The only thing I'm quibbling with you on, and I apologize for this, is the valuation of a business, which is what's the character of the underlying asset, and we would then get into a long question. But that's fixing the character of the property, as opposed to dividing the property up. We divide the property up based on the circumstances of the parties at the time that they appear in front of the court. And that's, I mean, that I believe is a well-established principle under the Wells decision. I mean, it's been followed through in the Burford case, which you may recall is actually a decree case. In the Burford case, we have one of the parties dying during the pendency of the domestic case itself, which creates all kinds of problems. And that's one of the reasons why we're suggesting here that we have to consider the circumstances of the parties. Because once the decree enters, it's possible for a party to have tremendous change. You can lose your job, you can get fired, you can have windfalls, is what we've lived. You can also have a party die. And even with that party dying, we believe that the trial court should have the ability to consider that financial circumstance, because it's now clearly relevant. Things are overwhelmingly changing. And the statutory and public policy issues that are in this area say what we're trying to do is design something that's going to equalize the financial position of the parties, and it's also operating in a way that's designed to minimize the harm of the parties. And so one is we desperately want to try to avoid this situation.
Go ahead, finish your sentence, and then I'll jump in.
Well, I've lost my thought.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to distract you.
You're far more important than I am.
Well, one of the underlying objectives of the Uniform Dissolution of Marriage Act, as opposing counsel suggested, is to minimize the ongoing conflict. And that's something that ultimately should be done in the benefit of the children in this equation as well. You stop the acrimony or reduce it, then that's going to help everybody who's involved. And so why doesn't that also militate in favor of the snapshot sort of approach that the Chief Justice was just, never mind the fact that it's the math equation, but it's also we just need to sort of stanch the flow of acrimony at a single point in time, too, or at least try to. Does that make sense?
I think I understand the point. And I will say that acrimony is a component of, not the acrimony, but the underlying divorce. You know this. Divorce is a profoundly emotional issue as it comes towards these parties. And we want to try to minimize the acrimony that's being presented in those cases. I don't think that we're going to minimize the acrimony by having a rule where we simply pick a date on the valuation of attorney's fees. The three policy arguments that I've seen in the public policies expressed in 1410.109 does speak to this. It says to mitigate the potential harm to the spouses and their children caused by the process of the legal dissolution of marriage. But the case law that construes that says what we are looking at fees to is to equalize the party's status and to ensure that nobody suffers undue economic hardship. And the issue that we're saying here is, and I'm going to gloss on this case a little bit so you have an idea, and these are not specific findings of fact, but our argument has been that Mr. DeConing's income changed or could change. And we all know that as of 2010, his income, he said, was $900,000. The expert came back and said, I think it was $700,000. And then it drops in the year of marriage down to $250,000. That expression, if his income is going up and can change that quickly, we want to pursue that financial circumstance. And so I don't think it involves a revaluation of the marital assets. The marital assets have been valued in and of themselves for the purpose of dividing the property. But we do need to know what the financial circumstance of that asset is. So if I think Justice Bocott had suggested that the business might appreciate in value substantially, we want to know what that appreciation is, but we don't have to divide that appreciation again. Otherwise, we get into, Chief Justice Rice, a circular argument of saying we have to continually revaluate. The court has entered permanent orders. It has entered the final orders on these specific issues.
But it doesn't stem the tide of discovery, I think is, and I'm sorry, Chief, it doesn't stem the tide of discovery. You still have to conduct discovery, do you not?
You can conduct discovery.
Well, I mean, I assume you asked for additional, or not you, your client asked for additional discovery in this case, and potentially that could lead to depositions, and that's, I think, what the Chief may have been alluding to this ongoing, and maybe even Justice Hood, ongoing acrimony,
I have to look to, with all due respect, I think that's a trial court's job. The discovery that was issued in this case was fairly narrow. It's a couple of bank account statements, it's a couple of credit card statements, it's some business financial statements, and it's a lease. There's just four groups of documents. I think, and maybe I'm wrong, I confess I was not trial counsel, but I think that that's a press or a return button four times. I want to look at the trial courts, and I want to say, Judge, if we've gone too far, I think you're going to let me know. If I've crossed that line, there are other grounds for protective orders other than relevance. We to have a rule that fixes it in time, as of the property or maintenance division, eliminates the one certainty that exists, and that certainty is change. And it also carves out attorney's fees different than we would carve out anything else. It treats it as a different kind of an entity, rather than saying, for all of these things that we approach them again at the time that we do them. And so, yes, there may be additional discovery. The trial court is in the best position to determine whether or not that discovery is relevant. For example, if a party were to die, we clearly have a change, but discovery may not be relevant.
Well, let me ask you this. So evidently, your client is taking the position that all of a sudden now the husband either has a whole lot more assets or makes a whole lot more money. So file a motion to modify maintenance based upon that property division, and the rules certainly the statutes that would apply for that, and seek attorney's fees based upon that. That's what's supposed to happen. What's not supposed to happen, in my opinion, is this sort of constantly open-ended question of attorney's fees for permanent orders,
waiting upon the condition of the stock market. I mean, I can picture the lawyers fighting over when the date of the continuance is going to be, depending upon whether the market is going up or down, which is more beneficial to their client. There simply has to be a date certain when all of this is evaluated, and you move forward from that with motions to modify if something changes.
I don't believe that that's the appropriate consideration. I recognize in your decision of iClick, you said that maintenance and attorney's fees both serve the same purpose, which is to care support of the parties of the children.
So they serve the same purpose of balancing. And you have to balance as of a point, and then if something changes, you have to rebalance. But there has to be a point in time when these determinations are made.
But with respect to attorney's fees and maintenance, I disagree that they are the same thing, or that we file a motion for maintenance to get attorney's fees. Attorney's fees is a separate entity. There was case law that linked attorney's fees with property and debt, and that was overruled by the Mitchell decision, or maybe it's the Ryder decision. And we said that attorney's fees is a separate beast. It's not to meet Ms. DeConing's present needs. It's not to satisfy her need for food, clothing, and shelter right now. It's to compensate and to give her the ability to litigate the course of this action and to divide the costs of that litigation equally between the parties. And so I understand that there is a desire to fix it. That desire is actually set up in 121, 122.
It's equal between the parties depending upon their ability to pay when, depending upon their ability to pay at permanent orders, not depending upon their ability to pay at any infinite number of times in the future, depending upon when the stock market goes up or goes down. And that's I think, where you in the Court of Appeals are failing to grapple with really the complexity of what the trial judge has to do in making these kinds of decisions.
I've never sat as a trial judge. I accept that. But I disagree that the permanent orders hearing, that I agree with the Court of Appeals position that the permanent orders hearing continues until we have a final judgment on all of these issues. And that therefore under 16.2, which would be the discovery issues, and under the equitable principles, we should consider the circumstances and the changes that occurred during that time. And I do not believe that that means that we have to look back into modifying the property divisions, because I view the, and I think this is clear under the Huff decision, that these things flow down. And it is clear that they do not flow up. I believe that it's very clear that the remand of an attorney's fees issue does not impact maintenance and it does not impact property, in part because they're different things and they serve different purposes. And because of that, I suggest that we have to look at the circumstances. I don't think this is commonplace. I do think that this is an extraordinary situation. And so I don't think that we're creating a situation where we have a tremendous amount of disagreement. And I candidly question, I understand that we want to have some certainty and that we want to fix the rise, but we have to serve the policy issues that relate to the attorney's fees issues.
Mr. Bailey, maybe a fresh look at this will help. Let's assume that, as you alluded to, divorces are obviously very emotional. Let's assume after the decree, instead of the business thriving, one of the parties falls on hard times and loses their job, you know, for whatever reason. Should those, then that changes dramatically their financial situation. Is that considered then?
I think that there is no better expression of circumstances that the trial court should consider at the second hearing than that one. The case law, in Re Marriage of Rainier, for example, says that one of our primary consideration is the earnings and the earning capacity of the spouses. And so there's, at the attorney's fees hearing, if there's been a change in that earning capacity, the trial court should consider that an allocated.
But isn't that, in effect, hurting the spouse that didn't fall apart based on the conduct of the spouse who did fall apart?
There are circumstances,
I guess what I'm trying to articulate is, as Justice Hood alluded to earlier, is sort of detaching the parties from each other's behavior.
I believe that there is still an interrelationship that occurs during the pendency of the case. When the spouses during the pendency of the case stand in, they are fiduciaries of one another under several of this court's cases and under 16.2. So I think that there is still that attachment. And I know that there's a concept that's called the marital partnership theory, which would end with the entry of the decree. But there's still link as we go forward. And as Chief Justice Rice would say, we would be, those changes punish, that's not the right word, but impact the other spouse. If someone loses their job, there is an impact. That's going to impact child support, it's going to impact maintenance, and it's, if we're doing post-decree motions, we may have those things coming up, but it also may impact the decree. What we would not want to be in that circumstance is to enter an order that the party who had whose circumstances fell apart, who had a change of circumstances for the negative, they cannot comply with. There are situations like this where we may have a marital pool of assets that we can look to, and maybe we're coming out of assets. But there are other situations where we're simply trying to solve the maintenance puzzle on an ongoing basis out of income. And so that negative change of circumstance, in my mind, speaks far more loudly to the necessity to look at the current circumstances at the time of the hearing. And I don't believe that we can solve that by having further motions, a motion to modify maintenance or a motion to modify child support. And so my suggestion, they may come, Lord knows, these cases are cases of continuing jurisdiction, but we want to try to resolve the parties' issues when they appear in front of the court. And to set up a different rule, I think, makes it unnecessarily complex as we approach this issue.
Counsel, if I might jump in, I'm over here, sorry. I guess I'm hearing both a proposition that the rule should always be examine the financial circumstances of the parties for purposes of attorney's fees at the date of the attorney's fees hearing, regardless. And yet I'm hearing that the justification for that is the potential for changed circumstances. And so I'm wondering if really what you're suggesting is a rule that is dependent upon changed circumstances. In other words, the court need not necessarily look at anything differently unless there's reason to believe that there's changed circumstances. Are you amenable to that sort of approach, or is it sort of a hard and fast, whatever the arbitrary date happens to be, whether it's 1 month, 6 months, a year, whatever that date is on the calendar, that's our snapshot?
Well, I think that the case law supports the conclusion that if there's no change of circumstances, then we would look at it back in time as of the permanent orders hearing. And I think that there is candidly, I would view it with some discretion, giving the trial court the ability to say, I'm going to allocate it based off of the following. This is what my consideration is. I candidly trust the court system enough to do that. This case comes up on a motion for a protective order. And so it's the ability to present the evidence of that change of circumstances. And just to say, here's what our current circumstances are. I can see situations where perhaps, Justice Boatwright's court might say, well, that's your fault that you lost the job, and therefore I'm going to do the following things. And so that's a discretionary position that might relate to the court. But even that discretionary position, you're putting evidence before the court that exists as to the circumstances at the time of the hearing. Have I answered your question? I kind of feel like I haven't.
I'm just struggling with whether you're asking for an always rule as set forth by the Court of Appeals opinion, or more of a it depends, and where there are changed circumstances, then yes, the court should revisit those changed circumstances. I'm just trying to pin down which of those boxes you're your argument falls into?
I believe that my argument is going to fall within the always, meaning this. If there are changed circumstances, we could, should consider those changed circumstances. That's the must. If there are no changed circumstances, then we're going to still have the circumstances of the parties at the time of the hearing. If the parties, and this does come up, if the parties agree that we're going to present it based off of the circumstances at the time of permanent order, then that's a different. What can happen in these cases is we, you know, many times that affidavit of attorney's fees is served just a couple of days before the hearing. And the trial court says, okay, we're going to have, if there's an objection to this, then we're going to, you know, push it out and treat it a little bit differently. So the trial court.
And I just want to warn you about to run out of time. So, because you want to wrap up, I'm having an answer. Thanks.
So for the reasons that I've expressed, we are requesting that this court affirm the court. Thank you very much for your time.
You have a few seconds left if you wish, Mr. Lund.
Do you think 18 seconds. I think what's really come out of this, especially, Your Honor, with your comments, is financial circumstances. You can't pick and choose what financial circumstances you're going to take into court at the time of attorney's fees hearing. You've got to look at property values and income. You have to recreate what happened at the final orders.
Thank you. All right, we are going to take a break. We'll be back in about 15 minutes. Thank you.